Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, working conservatives with no sense of humor, with anger. Good morning, everybody. What is it, Columbus Day? Is that the thing? So what, we got like four people out there listening to us because everyone else is sweeping in because of Columbus? Is that what's going on out there, Riley?
Well, no, actually, everyone's preparing for the big parade here in New York.
Oh, the Columbus Day parade that I've never been to in my life. What happens on that day?
Everybody marches up Fifth Avenue.
Let me ask the Italian. Hey, Chris Lopresto, is that an Italian thing, the Columbus Parade?
Or yes, it is.
It is? Do you Italians deal with the Columbus Day Parade?
We deal with it, and we enjoy it. We embrace it.
Uh-huh.
It is awesome.
Oh, good.
And but you know what?
He's got the half bad rap, half good rap. You know? I mean, he's the guy. Didn't he go to Cuba and kill a bunch of people before he came up here? Wasn't that the story of Columbus?
Well, yeah, that was part of the story. He killed a few people in Cuba.
Looking for gold.
Enslaved people. Everyone makes mistakes. Look at OJ.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Chris. How's it going all alone, sad little man, on the weekends without a girlfriend?
It's pretty good, man.
It is? Yeah.
I think I did like 20 hours of sports yesterday.
Oh.
So, yeah, I didn't need a girl.
I don't know anything about it. Just you and your sports and your food. That's nice, man. It's nice to see everybody back. John Crimmings, boy genius, resident from Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, his folks were in town, and they brought some sort of giant circular Danish that now sits in the other room.
It's called a kringle.
A kringle?
Yeah. A kringle,
how do you spell that?
K-R-I-N-G-L-E.
A kringle. So we got a kringle sitting in there. Like, I'm caring about the show right now. I got kringle
on
the brain.
Good. He just said it was a Danish. I was like, Danish. That's not so exciting.
It's a Danish delicacy.
It's a Danish the size of a tire. A Danish is a little thing you get in the counter. They're like, can we have a little cheese Danish? What's that right there? Not the size of a tire. And for some reason, that appeared to look like an anus to Chris Lopresto.
Oh, my God.
The first thing Chris Lopresto is like, look, it's like a giant butt.
Who buys an anus-shaped Danish?
Who thinks a tire looks like an anus? What the hell is wrong with
you? Have you ever seen an anus?
Yes, I have.
It looks like a tire.
Yeah, wait, who was the last person you were with? A giant? What is that? All right. Good. This is good Columbus Day stuff. Listen, the sound of women turning off the radios across the country. All right, let's talk about how can we shift gears into this? Hey, dude, there was an earthquake. How was that? Was that a good segue?
Yeah.
All right. This is Pakistan's worst ever earthquake. It has wiped out entire villages. It has buried roads and rubble. Schools have been breaking down. At least 20,000 people were killed. It could go up as high as 30,000. It's horrendous. There are moments when I see stuff like this, Riley, when I'm watching news footage of this, where I can't even fathom what a disaster of this magnitude could look like to these people.
Well, and I think that's part of being so far away. I think it was true also of the tsunami that happened the day after Christmas last year. It's one of those things that you really have a lot of trouble understanding the dynamics of. 20, 30,000 people killed in most likely in a matter of minutes. And of course, this is also Pakistan, which is significant in that this is the country that's supposed to be leading the fight in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Think that's on the back burner today?
There's a lot of independent speculative investigators out there that might have think that that Karl Rove caused this earthquake in order to distract from what he's going through, his fourth time testifying before the grand jury. But as I know, as an independent speculative investigator, this was a CIA attempt at the life of bin Laden. They're using a new experimental weapon that caused this type of horrendous
damage. 7.6 Richter scale earthquake? They can do that?
They got weapons that you don't even know about. But I don't want to take this lightly or joke about it. It's a horrendous situation. The United Nations said more than 2.5 million people need shelter after the magnitude of 7.6 earthquake. It's right along the Pakistan-India border. The offices of the Coordination of Humanitarian Relief said it urgently needed 200,000 winterized tents. Residents reported that people had started looting deserted homes and gas stations. There are shortages of food and water, and it's just horrible because you one thing you know, that even as bad as it got here with New Orleans, is that eventually something was done. And when you see the condition of this earthquake on television and what these people live in normally. Yeah. Who the hell knows how long it's going to take to remove that kind of damage and rubble? It's just awful.
It is awful. And apparently there were 25 aftershocks, the biggest of which was 6.2. So you're talking now about a 7.6 earthquake and then aftershocks that took place almost on the hour over a 24-hour period, and one of them was almost as powerful as the first one.
Oh, it's just like, it's so scary. It's just, you know, you got bird flu, you got earthquakes, you got floods, you got terror threats. I mean, the world is ending, finally. I think we all need a rest. But, hey, is there any way we can get back to the Danish after this? Is there any way that we can go back? Look at these guys in the room. We had like such a great time for like 3 minutes, and then bam, earthquake. How do you like that? Thousands of people dead. How's the Danish now? Huh? Look at these. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry to make that horrendous segue from us talking about our weekend. Grimmings, how was your birthday?
That was good.
What'd you do?
I went out to dinner. Went to took an NBC studio tour.
Oh, really? Cool. Yeah. I could have actually gotten you into Conan O'Brien. I have connections over there, but not on Sunday. So you saw the studios?
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, was it?
No.
Was, did you do that?
Are theirs nicer than ours?
Yeah.
They're NBC.
No, of course not.
Goliath, little Goliath, he's lost his mic privileges because he overslept today and he had no good excuse for it.
He was watching the Yankee game. I guess as a New Yorker that qualifies as a somewhat excuse.
Yeah. I was watching the Yankee game. I didn't oversleep.
Haven't you had enough time today? I mean, this is unbelievable. It's almost like, hey, you guys, no one's coming to the office. Let's just hang out all day and do this. All right, look, let's have a show. I don't know what the Democrats are planning on doing in response to Harriet Myers, but the Republicans are flipping out on all sides. I mean, previous to this nomination, Bush has been able to sort of ride a line with the Christo-fascist zombie brigade on one side and the corporations and their minions on the other side and old-school states' rights Republicans sort of in the middle. He's been able to garner the support of both the corporatocracy and the theocratic elements. Now he's managed to piss them all off. And this is an amazing thing, Riley, because Democrats are just sitting here watching this, and it looks like it's going to heat up. It looks like the infighting in the GOP is going to get even worse.
Yeah. Excuse me, because what you have are fissures within this party that Harriet Myers' nomination may have triggered, but now are appearing to be deeper, not just in Harriet Myers, but, I mean, like seismic fissures within the party.
That go back.
That go back. You got the White House fighting some Republicans in the Senate. You've got the conservatives who are not happy with Harriet Myers. You've got James Dobson inexplicably in the middle. We're going to get to that a little later on.
Yeah.
Because his role in all of this is weird. But I thought it was extremely strange that at the end of last week, Charles Krauthammer, who I don't agree with about what time of day it is, called Harriet Myers' nomination a joke and said it needed to be withdrawn. And that reverberated through the corridors of the Beltway all weekend.
Well, what I want you to explain to me in just a few minutes, Riley, is it seems that moderate Republicans, that somebody like Arlen Specter, It's very strange to me that Democrats or progressives or liberals or everybody on the other side of the neocon death cult and their minions here they're in this weird position that we're going to have to see what moderate Republicans do in response to this particular nomination, because Arlen Specter seems to want to protect her on some level out of fear of a more conservative justice being nominated.
Well, yeah, and he's trying to protect moderates from the conservatives, both in the Congress and in general, because what you have the possibility of having happen, and Specter realizes this better than anybody, is a wholesale revolt among the conservatives that ends up hurting the moderates and also exposing the fact that the conservatives don't have it the way they say they have it.
Exactly. As many of you know, some of you don't, Arlen Specter is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to get into that in a minute. We're also going to talk about James Dobson, who are, you know, Dr. Evil from the Family Research Council. He's become suspect of something that Arlen Specter wants to get to the bottom of. It's very important stuff. It's interesting stuff, and we're going to cover that. We're also going to cover Karl Rove appearing before the federal grand jury for the fourth time, and it looks like he is, I think, guilty of at least perjury, certainly treason, but that's certainly not going to be prosecuted, and maybe criminal conspiracy. There's a lot of speculation that can happen, and it's all very exciting. It's 15 past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. Morning Sedition. AirAmericaEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 20 past the hour. It's Monday. It's Mornings Edition on Air America Radio. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley. That's Iggy Pop in our head right now, singing about success, which I've tried. I've tried, my friends. I've done everything I can, Riley.
You have?
Yes, I've done my best here at Air America. I really have. I've given it my all, and that's all I can give. We'll see what happens. Anyways, moving on. Here we go. The thing about, I just made a mistake that I'd like to correct myself, because I get these people mixed up. I get these Christo-fascist zombie brigade leaders mixed up. It's actually Anthony Perkins is from the Family Research Council. James Thompson, of course, from Focus on Family. Now, let's talk about George Bush in relation to the evangelical community. First of all, I think it's important to show right now that in an Ipsos poll, an AP Ipsos poll, the percentage of people who strongly approve of Bush's job performance, the reason that word is important is this would indicate what's left of the base.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, strongly approve. Overall, from January 2005, he has dropped 6 points from 27% to 21% overall, record. This is the overall approval ratings, strongly approval ratings. So this really only applies to his most committed followers. And that's down to 21%. That's incredibly low. These guys are starting to jump ship. Independence, okay, has dropped. They're down to 11% who people who strongly approve for Bush. White evangelicals, this is extremely important, considering that these are the people who think that he's their guy. That has dropped from January in 2005, which it was at 49%, to 33%. 30, you all right, Riley?
No, I'm fine. It's just that the cough button suddenly didn't work. It was like, okay, let me press the button.
Bah. I think I got phlegm in my ears.
Yeah.
All right, so, but here we go. I know, it's a new studio. We're still trying to hammer that stuff out. But white evangelicals, October, this month, 2005, 33% strongly approved. That is diminishing, Riley. And the reason it's diminishing is that we've always known that Bush has spoken in some sort of religious code.
Yes.
He's been careful. You know, it's a religious code. We know he claims to be born again. We know he hints at supporting extreme social conservatives, but yet he doesn't hang out with them that often. And they're starting to realize that. The Christo-fascist zombie brigade is starting to feel used.
Well, yeah, because what they're starting to realize is that Bush's heart isn't in this.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Their hearts are. Dobson, Perkins, Wildman, all of these guys who have been spending the last quarter of a century developing this evangelical religious political base for a Republican candidate, obviously. And here's their guy, and suddenly they look up one day and they realize, wait a minute, he's not really one of us.
Yeah.
That's a scary prospect for them, because they figured, and you heard people say this after the election last year, now is their time.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. It's important not to forget. You know, we talked to Christopher Hedges on Friday out there in New Jersey. Christopher Hedges is writing a new book on American fascism, which is going to be Christian theocratic style fascism. And this movement has roots that go back to a pre-Reconstruction South. This movement has roots in racism. It has roots in the Klan. It has roots in the worst of America. And now they have gone, you know, mainstream by sort of repackaging the idea of Christianity. Some of it doesn't even involve Jesus that much as it does huge churches that take social actions and restructure entire towns around their belief system. So they have a base, but I'll tell you, a lot of them are starting to detract from this president. Some of them feel abandoned on the same-sex marriage issue. Some are still pissed off at his father for bringing Souter into the court. Some are mad because they feel that there are so many other judges with a clearer record of denying rights to Americans that he could have chosen from.
Well, and see, there is a deeper root cause, I think, in a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with the fact that Republicans have been cultivating these evangelicals to some extent against their will. Evangelicals have not been a political force of their own volition for all that long. Many of them have stayed away from politics, have stayed away from the polls until last year, when Karl Rove reached out to them, and Rove's absence, because he's fighting this other thing, is an important part of why this little coalition is starting to shatter as well. Rove was Bush's messenger to them.
Right, and apparently this is where we get the point of contention in terms of what Rove might have said to James Dobson from, you know, from the
focus, on the,
focus on the family. I don't want to get those mixed up again. And also, you have to understand, on a basic level, their big fear is that Myers, Harriet Myers, though an evangelical, mm-hmm. might actually honor a separation of church and state in herself and be an effective interpreter of the Constitution and how it breathes to address the rights of an evolving America. See, this is their big fear, is that she might honestly understand that a religion is supposed to be kept in yourself. That yeah. it's not something that should be legislated. It's not something that should be, you know, put into law in terms of the separations of church and state coming together. I mean, the Christo fascists are really against any type of evolution, including that of the constitutional approach to new issues.
Well, you know, one of the other things, Mark, and this is starting to come out in published reports more and more, is the notion that a lot of these evangelicals believe that there's always going to be a clash between them and the larger society, that they can't envision a situation where they actually do win to the point that society changes, that they need that tension between where they are and where the rest of society is, and they now realize that George Bush is essentially where the rest of society is.
Well, thank God on some level, because, you know, you got evangelicals that, look, and there are plenty of profound Christians who are progressive, who have liberal values, as is found in the Acts of Christ. I'm certainly not taking anything away from Christianity. But these people are really about redefining government and culture in terms of a strict, almost, you know, Taliban-like Christian morality of their own design. So it's not like these are religious people. They're not victimized. This is a very Christian country. But these people always make themselves out to be this victimized bunch because they are, in the sense that they want to usurp what America stands for. These people are anti-American in understanding how a democracy is supposed to work, because they want to restrict it to a type of fascist state that has religious law. So of course they're marginalized. It's because they're anti-American, and this is the one good thing that this president might be doing right now, is disenfranchising radical Christianity from the governmental process. I hope it works.
Yep.
We'll get into James Dobson and Karl Rove in just a second. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, it's 34 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Mark Maron here with Air America Radio's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
And it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program, and it's Monday here at Air America. It's Columbus Day. How's that grab you?
I'm shook up, man. I'm shook up. I just found out Chris Lopresto told me I own VIG on the money.
For Brenda McDonald's present?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when
I gave him half on Friday, but now he said I own VIG on the other half.
You better watch out. He's going to send Pashman over you. Pashman's going to be the contractor, the heavy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, is little Goliath all right, man? I'm getting cryptic messages on my information sheets and stuff. Cryptic messages in the form of errors and weird. Hey, dude, you know, I hate to bother you. Put him on the mic. Put
I thought
Goliath
you banned him for Columbus Day.
No, he's. Hey, dude, what happened, man? I don't understand.
Sorry, man. I don't know what's going on.
He's high. I guarantee you, he's high.
Wait, I'm not high.
You said it was about. What?
Sleepy, that's all. I'm sorry.
What's sleepy? Is this sleepy?
I guess Lopresto wasn't the only one got some over the weekend, huh?
That guy. Sweet, you know, Goliath did not get any.
That's true. I didn't.
You didn't, right?
No.
Not even foreplay?
No. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, you're going to be all right, right?
I think so, yeah.
All right. Was there
man.
Any of this last night?
Whoa!
I had a button here that didn't work. Damn buttons!
That's too bad.
All right, let's get on with the important stuff.
hanging? No, what was the button?
But I'm not going to tell you what the button was. It's not funny without the sound. It's not funny without the sound. I can't. Like, what am I supposed to do? An impression of a bong hit? All right, here we go. You all right, buddy? It's all right. I was young, too, once. I remember. So, in a few minutes, we're going to tell you why the terror threat here in New York was sort of a little bit of a sham. Yeah, not an entire sham, but it was not based in much. And also, I want to talk a bit about Karl Rove, who, look, he's going down, and there's no doubt about it. It's just now it's a matter of how much he's going down. I mean, there's new evidence coming out. There's all kinds of, like, well, I thought I said, and I forgot that I, and a lot of that going on in these testimonies, which is kind of exciting in terms of from where we stand, because real things, real action might be being taken to arrest these criminals. But let's finish up with this James Dobson thing. James Dobson, of Focus on Family, has claimed several times lately that he received information that Harriet Myers will provide the vote that overturns Roe v. Wade. He was involved in a conference call from White House aides, including Karl Rove, explaining their support for Myers. What that means, I don't know. But here's where you got this weird moment where you got to say, Arlen Specter is saying he's going to get to the bottom of it. If there are backroom deals being made, he wants to know what they are and who's involved, and he wants to get to the bottom of that, and he's the guy heading the questioning. So I have to say, go Arlen.
You know, this has required some improvisational thinking on the part of the Bush people, and with the exception of Rove, who's busy elsewhere, they don't have any improvisational thinkers in that camp. So now what's happening is you have Harriet Myers being pilloried. I mean, pilloried. Called a joke by a conservative commentator. People talking about the Federalist Papers. Most Americans don't know what the Federalist Papers are. But yet you have these conservatives whacking this woman who's supposed to be one of them. And the Bush administration has become desperate to find somebody who will publicly back her. So they found James Dobson. And what did they, why is James Dobson backing her? Because James Dobson says he's been told something which he will not divulge. But Mark, I think you're absolutely right. It has to do with how Myers would vote on Roe v. Wade, which she's not going to go in front of the Judiciary Committee and admit to, but he has been given assurances that she'll do the right thing. Now, Arlen Specter, being a pretty smart guy, is saying, wait a minute. If there have been some assurances made, I want to know about them. Mm-hmm. The committee ought to know about them. The full Senate ought to know about them. And, of course, if that's the case, she's done. All right? If she is said to anybody, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to overturn Roe v. Wade. She's finished as a nominee.
And this is weird because, as we talked about before, Arlen Specter, it was one gunman, Specter.
right. From his time on the Warren Commission.
Yes, it was Arlen, it was a lone gunman, Specter. Is basically, you're telling me on one level that he wants to get to the bottom of this with Myers, but he also wants to protect her on another level because he's afraid of what the next nominee might look like.
He's afraid of what the next nominee might look like because he knows that someone like Michael Luttig or some of these other people that whose names have been bandied about will get an instant filibuster from the Democrats. And he does not want to have. That would rupture that little compromise they worked out. So now the Republicans are between a rock and a hard place, particularly the moderate Republicans, the Susan Collinses and the Olympia Snows and the Arlen Specters, who want to see a moderate come forward as a nominee, no matter how much it pisses off the base.
The reason they're talking about the Federalist Papers these days, we were reading some of that last week, is because Alexander Hamilton basically wrote about how the Senate must protect itself from cronyism.
And protect the rest of America from cronyism.
Yeah, well, yeah, how the Senate must protect any sort of nominees to any sort of post within the government on a high level from cronyism, and how, why that's bad for America is obvious. And this is all happening, as you said, Riley, is that a lot of people want to attribute Rove's with having this amazing capacity of organizing everything, and that there's always another angle, and many times there is. But I think they're honestly getting sloppy. I think this guy may be, you know, some sort of evil genius, but how much can he keep going at once? Because it seems like he's stuck. He's caught in a lie. He might have perjured himself. And this, just for your information, Karl Rove went up before the federal grand jury to testify for a fourth time. Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, you know, a real conservative on Fox News, predicted on Sunday that there would be at least one, if not more, indictments of senior White House officials. Last week, we were hearing as many as 22 indictments. It's been supposed that target letters from the grand jury have been sent to Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, even Ari Fleischer, I've heard, in some areas. And now, I don't know what we can speculate, but let's begin the games.
All right, let's speculate. All right, no, let's not speculate. Let's start with a fact. Karl Rove lied to somebody.
Yeah.
He either lied to Bush, he lied to the grand jury more than once, he lied to Matt Cooper, he lied to Stephen Hadley, he must have lied to somebody. There are too many contradictory stories in all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Now, we knew about the conversation that he had with Matt Cooper. Everybody Matt Cooper exposed the conversation that he had with Matt Cooper. Rove, up until now, has kept his mouth shut about the substance of that conversation with Matt Cooper. But now we know that on the same day that took place, July 11, 2003, he fired off an email to Stephen Hadley, who was Condoleezza Rice's number two over at the National Security Council.
Right.
Now, Stephen, in that email, he said he did not take the bait when Cooper began asking him about the whole connection between Wilson and the vice president and Wilson's wife.
And what effect that the yellow cake story had on Bush's presidency.
On Bush's presidency, and most important, on Dick Cheney, because Dick Cheney was the one who, at least from a public standpoint, was the one that sent Wilson over there in the first place.
Right. So let's try and parse this out a little bit. So Karl Rove goes in to give testimony before federal prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald for a fourth time. That was on Friday. Now, I have to assume that there was no way he would go unless he was trying to save his ass. Am I right?
Yeah, he is at this point, yeah.
And then this time, as you said, it was about a crucial email that Rove said he just overlooked somehow. And we know that this guy doesn't overlook anything. And, as you said, the possibility that he perjured himself by not addressing a conversation he had with Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper or characterizing it in a different way. Not only did he not tell the grand jury, he apparently didn't tell the FBI about it, and he didn't tell his hero and puppet Bush, which I think is a lie. I think that on someone's going to have to fall on the knife here. And somebody is going to have to, you know, these guys, bottom line, the way this always works is they got to protect their president for as long as possible. But there's absolutely no way that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Andrew Card, Alberto Gonzalez, all of these guys, Karl Rove included, Scooter Libby, they all knew what was going on. You couldn't know. I mean, there were 11 or so leaks of this thing. I mean, 11 separate instances, at least, in which the administration disclosed information on plane. So many people knew about this that I don't think there's any other charge outside of perjury, which is going to be, perjury is going to reveal itself as secondary charges in this thing to the criminal conspiracy charge. I think that's what he's going after.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Karl Rove says that the conversation with Matthew Cooper from Time Magazine started out talking about welfare reform. Now, why Matt Cooper would call Karl Rove about welfare reform is absolutely beyond me, okay, or why they would have had an extended conversation. In fact, Cooper has written that he doesn't recall a discussion of welfare reform. Now, here's the nexus of the problem for Karl Rove.
What could that conversation have been with Rove and welfare reform? I got an idea. We're thinking about killing all the poor people.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah, right? What else could they have been talking about as far as welfare reform? But see, Matt Cooper also testified before that grand jury.
Uh-huh.
And the problem for Karl Rove may well be the documented testimony of Matt Cooper about what the substance of that conversation was, and the constantly shifting position of Karl Rove about what that conversation was. See, Cooper probably has notes to back up his side of the story. What's Rove got?
Yeah.
Nothing. Other than his word, which isn't worth much.
Well, it's interesting how as things evolve, like these guys think they can get away with something initially, and then because of the persistence of this grand jury, they have to go back and double back and now recover themselves, because he has talked to so many people, and now there is a new notebook. A new notebook. All of a sudden, there's Judith Miller, the reporter that was in jail, protecting Scooter Libby, protecting Dick Cheney, protecting her source, who eventually went and testified because Scooter Libby told her to. But apparently, there's talk that Scooter Libby was prodded by the federal prosecutor to tell her to go, or you know, his butt's in a sling. So all the facts of this are all just coming down to the fact that all these guys are scrambling now because they've said one thing, and now because the federal prosecutor, the grand jury, has looked at so much evidence from all of them that they can actually just look at a big board and say, oh, that one was lying, and this one is doubling back on what he said. And this, so they, it's coming down or coming up to a head here where these guys can't lie anymore because it's being corroborated.
I want to know, and I hope, you know, the New York Times is promising to do an extensive article about Judith Miller's situation, although they're going to have to postpone it. But when it comes out, I want to know exactly how and when and under what circumstances the Times discovered a 2-year-old notebook in its Washington bureau that is somehow pertinent to this. What was it, in somebody's drawer and they forgot?
Great.
Was it like Judith Miller?
Way.
She got any kids? Were there like, you know, pictures or something?
Somebody
tic-tac-toe on this bad boy? Somebody just said, whoa, there's a notebook here.
You know what it was? It was some smart, you know, possibly Democratic operative, maybe an intern who said, oh, this just hanging out here, this might be useful later.
Yeah.
I'm drop this off a little later. Well, here's what it all means for Roe. There's a lot of dates. There's a lot of things we could talk about. We've talked about this a lot. There are timelines available of how this all unfolds. But, you know, what we're really looking for now, what we're trying to speculate now, is what's going to happen when these indictments come down, when and if they come down. What it could all mean about Roe's new testimony, Roe's testimony on Friday, is that he perjured himself. There could be new info in this widening conspiracy of who's involved. And then there's some speculation that Fitzgerald, the federal grand jury, the prosecutor, is working a new angle that includes the possible use of a provision in the federal espionage and censorship law that makes it a crime to willfully provide classified information about national defense matters to someone not entitled to it. So there's even the possibility that he's looking for new and exciting loopholes to prosecute these guys on. So this is all going to go down in a few weeks. We're just going to try and keep you abreast of it. But the one thing that you need to know for sure is that Karl Rove is a little panicky. His lawyers are not as confident as they are. His lawyers are saying things like, the prosecutor hasn't decided anything. He told me. Okay, so let's just keep cool.
Yeah, it sounds different from a couple of days ago.
Well, that's for sure. That's for sure. We're going to have the iNews in just a minute. We're going to give you the sort of breakdown of a terror threat that kind of fizzled out in a way, but it did cost this city a lot of money. And it's interesting. Did you feel safer or less safe?
I stayed the hell out of the trains.
Well,
that's what I did.
It was pretty interesting to see it really go into action like it did last Friday. It's 47 past the hour. We'll get into that. We got the iNews, so stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
All right, 52 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hey, folks, this Friday we're going to be broadcasting from Restaurant Florent again in New York's Meatpacking District. So come on down. We're going to have some funny people. We're going to have some interesting people. We're going to have free coffee. We're going to have prizes. That's Florent down on Gainsfort.
Gainsfort.
Sure, why do I have such a problem with that, man? It's unbelievable. So last week, you know what? Let me do the iNews first. Sometimes it can be tough to figure out what the headline are saying, so thank God we got this Wi-Fi. What is it? The iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's feed it some headlines. All right, from the Associated Press. Bush takes on conservative. I bet you he's having a good time right now. Brendan P.W. McDonald on his honeymoon, probably in Mexico.
I think he leaves today.
Oh, did you talk to him after the wedding? God, he just doesn't really like us. It's really a work thing with him, isn't it? All right. From the Associated Press.
Purely business.
Bush takes on conservatives over Myers. Bush takes on conservatives over Myers. Translation. Indefensible president defends indefensible nominee. There you go. From Washington Post. Bennett defends remarks on black abortions. Translation. Bennett's chronic gambling continues. Loses big playing race cards. From ABC News. Hillary Clinton inducted into Women's Hall of Fame. Women's Hall of Fame. Translation. Hillary receives coveted You Go Girl. All right. So, you know, I guess because I am chronically or innately sort of propelled or propulsed or whatever the word is, I'm a generally frightened guy in a lot of ways. And when I read about a terror threat, as skeptical as I may be, I mean, the terror threat on Friday had been around since the previous Wednesday, at least. The threat to New York subway system apparently originated in Iraq, and it was supposed to involve the use of explosives hidden in bags, briefcases, or baby strollers. The threat was explained in a Homeland Security Department memo last Wednesday. And it mentioned Friday and Sunday as possible dates of attack. So, of course, the terror threat comes down last Thursday night during the debates that Michael Bloomfield was not present at.
Bloomberg.
What did I say?
Bloomfield was
the guitar player for the Blues Project and also some Bob Dylan records, who's been dead for many years. So if he would have made that announcement, it would have been really weird and exciting.
Which Dylan albums?
I believe he was on
Blonde on Blonde.
No, maybe he was on Blonde on Blonde. He was with Al Kooper and that whole band on right when Dylan went electric. Highway 61 Revisited, maybe. Why don't you look it up on the internet while you're not working?
I got it.
All right, and let me know what you come up with. So here's the deal: a previously reliable source in Iraq who had trained at a terrorist camp in Afghanistan apparently tipped authorities to a terror plot involving like 15 to 20 people. All right, the tipster in Iraq failed some sections of a polygraph test, but passed the section pertaining to the information about the New York threat. Now, the question is, that threat gets filtered through different sources. It gets filtered through Homeland Security Department. It comes down to the New York officials, and someone has to make a decision. Now, the bottom line is, it was an uncorroborated threat. They never found no 15 to 20 people. They only had this one guy in his word, which doesn't mean it was bad information.
It doesn't mean it was bad information. And here's the deal here, Mark. One of the things that's coming out of this is a beef between the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI. The FBI was standing next to Michael Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, New York's police commissioner, when he made the announcement about the threat and the elevated security. The FBI.
So let's talk about that, because the FBI, some of the agents who were involved in the interrogation of this guy in Iraq were sort of skeptical, but the Department of Homeland Security memo was issued on Wednesday. Now, is there a chance that these guys, certainly after what we saw happen with FEMA and with Michael Brown, who was an incompetent, that these guys, at the very least, never want to be left holding the bag looking like an incompetent, so they're going to place it, as Bush said, the reason Bush supported Bloomberg in this is that he said, look, we give the information to the city, to the state, and they make their own decisions. Like, they are really trying to push the responsibility onto state officials because they don't want to look like idiots again.
Well, here's the problem that the feds have in this instance. Ray Kelly, New York City's police commissioner, is a counterterror expert. He has served in the federal government working on counterterrorism. So he's no Rube from some other, from some small town someplace, some police commissioner that nobody has to pay any attention to. He's got the experience. Right. On the other hand, you have a situation where Michael Chertoff and the Department of Homeland Security they already look like idiots coming out of Katrina. They don't want to look like idiots twice. And they really, and this is something that happens among different bureaucracies, they really detest the New York City Police Department.
866-303-2270. Was it a sham? Does it matter? What do you want them to do? I mean, are they just supposed to not take any action? What do you think they should? What should we do here in New York when we get a 866-303-2270 when we get a threat like that? 57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Six past the hour. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition today on Columbus Day. If you're up and listening, welcome aboard. Nice to have you. We're about to take some calls from you about the terror threat over the weekend, whether or not it was overreacting, whether you think it was a sham. But, I'm under the belief that, you can't have it both ways, man. You just can't have it both ways. If we want to feel safe for protecting the city, I have to assume that there are people out there that want to blow trains up. They did it in Madrid. They did it in England. We know that we're a target here. I'm not being paranoid. I'm not supporting any particular political agenda on behalf of Bloomberg. Obviously, the timing was suspect because he wasn't at a debate, and the timing was suspect on a national level because of Rove and all the things that are going on, the whole docket of political scandal that is revolving around the White House. But the bottom line is, this threat came out of Iraq. It seemed like that the source was a real source. He passed the polygraph test. What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do in the city? It also costs the city a fortune in paying police overtime to take these kind of actions. But what if something had happened? Then where does the finger pointing go? What is the plan, folks? 866-303-2270. Let's update some of these stories. Pakistan and India are, of course, recovering or trying to recover or just barely through one of the worst earthquakes ever, certainly in that region. 20,000 to 30,000 people are dead. The quake was felt from central Afghanistan to western Bangladesh. Schools have fallen down. Buildings have fallen down. The quake was centered about 60 miles northeast of Islamabad in the mountains of Kashmir. The U.S. Geological Society said there had been at least 26 aftershocks, including a 6.2 aftershock, which is huge. The United Nations said more than 2.5 million people need shelter after the 7.6 earthquake. The Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Relief said it urgently needed 200,000 winterized tents. The U.S. is sending 8 military choppers to help with rescue efforts, and President Bush promised financial assistance, whatever that means. India, Britain, Russia, China, Turkey, Japan, Germany, and Israel have also offered assistance. I just hope that we follow through with the assistance that we say we're going to give and not pull back on it the last minute. We are also going to be talking about in the show, you know, Karl Rove's involvement in the plane leak. He's spoken in front of the grand jury for a fourth time. He's testified on Friday. A little later in the show, we'll get into that. And we also want to talk a little bit about Bush's poll numbers in terms of his base, the evangelical base, the base in general, the people that you thought would believe in him no matter what. Percentage of people who strongly approve of Bush's job performance dropped tremendously, Riley, tremendously, this month in relation to January of 2005, where percentage of people who strongly approved of Bush was 27% in January. Now it is October, and that number is around 21. The most significant number is white evangelicals in January of 2005. 49% of them strongly approved of President Bush's job performance. Now that number is down to around 33%, and that all revolves around the nomination of Harriet Myers, the reaction to Katrina, some of his stances on social issues, which never seemed to follow through. It seems like he's cutting these guys loose, Riley.
Well, he's cutting them loose. They're cutting him loose. Some of these people that want to be president in 2008 who thought they could pimp off of Bush's legacy aren't thinking that way anymore. They're trying to cut away from him, just like the evangelicals are cutting away from him. The man has become poison.
And also, that also plays out in the fact that Republican politicians in multiple states have decided not to run for Senate next year.
That's
prominent
right.
Republicans have passed up races in North Dakota, West Virginia. The White House has failed to get their big gun candidates to run in Florida, Michigan, Vermont. I mean, look at that. Casey, the guy who's running against Rick Santorum for his Senate seat, way ahead in Pennsylvania. Rahm Emanuel, the Democratic Congressional Committee chairman, says 50 or more seats are in play. Let me just reach out to you folks. This is a good time to try to run for Congress. I mean, if you're a Democrat with a message and you've got an angle, even if you don't follow, even if you think that the Democratic Party does not have a platform, make your own, run for office, get involved.
Well, you know, the Rovian strategy for continued Republican dominance meant that there were going to be serious Republican challengers in red states that have Democratic senators, places like Nebraska, places like Florida. These different states that had, and West Virginia is another example, where Robert Byrd is up for re-election again next year. And what they're finding is that the people they thought would run aren't interested. They're staying in their same places. Arch Moore, who's a former governor of West Virginia, his daughter was one of the people that they were trying to get to challenge Byrd. She said, no thanks, I'm staying where I am in Congress.
See, the stink is that bad that these people are going to wait it out as opposed to running this Senate run.
Absolutely.
All right, let's take some calls about the terrorist alert, the terror alert, and you know what we're supposed to do. But Lonnie listening in, Eugene up late. How are you, Lonnie?
Hey, Lonnie.
Hey, thanks for the show, man. It's really great.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for listening.
But, you know, I don't live in New York, and I've never actually been to New York, but I actually think that the gig is up with these terrorist alerts.
Oh, yeah?
I really think that really what it's doing is the opposite effect. It's making people think about having a peaceful kind of culture where we're not a military environment.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing is about fear, fear, fear. And I think it's a backlash, but on a second note of that,
yeah,
I actually think we should look forward to a terrorist attack, because I think because their rates are so low, the polls are so low, they're going to let something happen.
So you're saying that talking about that they might let something happen to distract and get people reinvigorated with fear.
Fear factor back up.
Yeah.
It's all about fear factor. But actually, I think the gig is up on the whole deal. I think people smell
they don't buy it
already.
That's interesting.
And I think it's moving towards peace. I mean, I'm a person who's never gotten actively involved in tomorrow. For the first time, I'm going to the University of Oregon and getting involved. There's a project called protestforpeace.org, and I'm going to go there and talk to Brian Bogart, who is the director of the, I think it's called the Studies for Peace, if you
All right.
up on the Internet.
Well, thank you, Lonnie. Thank you. It was nice talking to you. You take care. Okay, bye. So as she's saying that no matter what, that these threats are most of them are hoaxes. They're just meant to instill fear and sort of regroup that base of fear that people were experiencing pre the election and that they're using that and that people are tired of it. I think that's one angle. But I, you know, in a more practical sense, you know, living here in New York, you know, I want to know, you know, what the hell we're supposed to do, whether the threat is uncorroborated or whether it seems like it might not be a real threat. Should they just not tell us at all and deal with it on a law enforcement level?
Yeah, but see, the great risk in not saying anything is that something happens and people come back and say, why didn't you say anything?
Exactly.
Remember, the presidential daily briefing of August 6, 2001 was a smoking gun. As far as George W. Bush was concerned.
It's so weird that because this terror threat has been so exploited, like Lonnie was talking about, to political ends, that none of us have any faith in any of it. David, listening in Miramar, Florida, how are you?
Hi, David.
How you doing?
I'm good,
all
man.
Right.
What's
guys,
on you?
You're missing a salient point here.
What?
I'm going to point it out if you don't mind.
You got it.
Okay, when you torture and abuse people and you have a climate of torture, people make up stuff.
Okay.
You got popsicle sticks under your fingernails, you're going to come up with a pretty neat story.
Right.
So that gets passed on. Karl Rove says, whoa, we got all these unemployed actors and comedians and celebrities in New York. Let's involve them in the story. And so you got 10 million people put on a charade, and it scares the bejesus out of everybody in the United States and adds to a plan.
Uh-huh. Now,
they just took advantage of what happens when you abuse people.
Right, the unemployed actors and comedians, who is that exactly?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we'll have to look around.
You're talking to an employed comedian.
And that's what he's doing. Yeah. I am gainfully employed, sir, but appreciate your call, David. I understand what he's saying. But if we are to believe any press whatsoever, I think he's right. When you have a culture of torture and you're doing that to get information out of people, certainly people will make some stuff up. But what I'm talking about here is that you've got polygraph tests. Now, polygraphs are not always right, but the one part of the polygraph test that this guy's passed was the idea that he was saying something truthful about a terror threat. But he said, but David is right, despite the fact that he took a shot at me, and it might be from the other side, that, you know, the culture of torture and terror is going to force people to do that.
But see, now the question is, does Mike Bloomberg react to the fact that this guy might have been tortured by not saying anything? And obviously, that cannot be the case.
Okay. Well, thanks for your calls. We're going to have David Gray up here in a minute. The other day he came by and played some songs. Pashman and I hung out. Riley was, I think, at the dentist.
I was at the dentist.
Yeah, he had some major
mouth stuff. Got another one this week, too.
Oh, boy.
Who you got coming up? Rumsfeld while I'm at the dentist?
Sure, I think Rumsfeld is finally going to come now that you're going to be gone. But, you know, speaking of Rumsfeld, he apparently put the word out and got, the guy we had on the show from Now That's FedUp.com.
Oh, yeah.
That guy's in jail, dude. They busted him for obscenity. Not because he was putting pictures of grotesque war footage on his site, but because of the porn. But don't tell me it ain't all connected.
Oh, no.
Given that as many pornographers are in this country, they go after that guy. They was gonna,
of all people.
Teach a lesson. That's what they're trying to do. We'll talk about that in a minute. 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio. This is Morning's Edition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
We're going to have David Gray in here. Well, he was in here, but, you know, it'll sound like he's here. Especially if you're just tuning in and you didn't hear what I just said. You didn't hear what I just said. He's going to sound like he's here right now. How do you like that? What difference? Why am I even saying that now? The people that I'm talking about aren't even listening. Now I'm all wrapped up in my head here. Hey, look, folks, let's do the job listing, shall we? We know that a lot of people out there are out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com. We want to help, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Background. Last week, it was reported that Al-Qaeda was posting help wanted ads on the internet. It might be true. We found this job listing that just on the face of it seems suspicious. Terrorists wanted. Do you need money for college? Of course not. Not while the Yankee infidels have their boot on your neck. Well, maybe it's time you stopped wasting your talents and blew yourself up in a marketplace full of screaming Shiites. We're Al-Qaeda, and we're looking for bright and motivated individuals. Actually, just motivated will do. Al-Qaeda is an organization on the move, and we don't just mean in the mountains of Pakistan. We have locations all over the globe, and as an Al-Qaeda employee, you will be eligible for one-way travel to one of them. At Al-Qaeda, high turnover guarantees chances for career advancement. Our employees often go from raw recruits to martyrdom in a matter of days. You can even have a future in management. Every single employee who works with our Baghdad operation is officially recognized by the United States as the number two person in charge. Minorities are encouraged to apply, and by minorities, we mean people who don't look like Al-Qaeda members. So don't wait. Apply to Al-Qaeda and start working toward your 72 virgin payoff today. All right. Chris Wilson, who has been a guest on our show, the webmaster of NowThat'sFedUp.com, an amateur porn site that offered membership to soldiers in Iraq for personal pictures from the war zone, was busted. The pictures on the site were graphic and grotesque. We saw them. Some of the captions were smug and disturbing, but they were pictures from soldiers in Iraq of horrendously brutalized Iraqis, victims of war. The Army investigated the soldiers, the pictures, and claimed they weren't from U.S. soldiers. The military didn't take any legal action against the soldiers, but gave them a stern rap on the wrist, saying, don't do that. Meanwhile, Wilson, who I said as before, it was a guest on our show, gets busted for obscenity, for porn. He is being held in jail under a $151,000 bond on one count of wholesale distribution of obscene material and 300 misdemeanor charges related to the website. Now, dude, he is one of a million pornographers on the internet. Why him? Because you don't screw with the Pentagon. They'll do what they'll let you do what you want if you mind your own business. But this guy rattled their cage.
Well, not only did he rattle their cage, the notion that a local sheriff would arrest this guy on obscenity charges is, and by the way, at the same time say that these are the most horrific examples of filthy, obscene materials we have ever seen. Now, I don't know if he's talking about the Iraq soldiers' pictures or whether he's talking about the porn.
He's not. He's talking about the porn.
All right.
This is about the porn.
All right, so let's talk about the porn. There are 42 hotels in Polk County. Want to take a guess or want to speculate about how many of them carry porn on their pay-per-view channels?
Yeah, and you just have to, you know, all you got to do is charge it to your room.
Charge it to your room.
You don't have to send them, you don't have to send them pictures in return.
Well, I don't think that Sheriff Grady Judd from Polk County, Florida, is going to be banging on Rupert Murdoch's door. He's half owner of DirecTV.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, and they bring porn into hotel rooms. Is that filthy, obscene porn? Does he know that whether or not this stuff is going on under his nose like this? The only difference is the fact that Chris Wilson was wanted by the Pentagon.
Yeah, I think so. They worked through the federal government and got their lackeys on this guy and went through local law enforcement and busted him. I mean, this has happened before. People are made an example of. I mean, this guy was publishing pictures that the military did not want to be seen. They're not going to stop the soldiers from doing what they're doing. These guys, they all have cameras. They just said, don't do that.
Yep.
And they're going to say that they weren't from the soldiers in the military, but they clearly were. And they're going to make an example out of him. I mean, this happened with Harry Reams, a guest on our show, who was made an example of because of his involvement in Deep Throat. The actor was made an example on obscenity charges to send a sort of current through that community.
Well, yeah, and you know what they're betting on? They're betting that Chris Wilson, who's what, 27 years old?
An ex-police officer, which I didn't know.
An ex-guy. I didn't know that either. But, well, let's say 27-year-old Chris Wilson does not have resources forever. Mm-hmm. And what they figure is, even though they bring him up on all this trumped up foolishness, he's going to have to spend enough money fighting it that maybe he can't keep the website up.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting is that it was one of the only places that I saw some of the most graphic depictions of what is being done in Iraq, because they've already successfully, this administration has successfully intimidated the news media. They've put censorship filters on any photographs that come out of Iraq that might even show the heinous, grotesque crimes of war that are being committed over there on all sides. I mean, you know, whether they're dead Iraqis, they're dead Americans. There's a lot of dead people over there from one reason or the other. And we've got a president that doesn't go to military funerals. We don't see pictures of military funerals. We certainly don't see graphic images of the war zone. And this is how it had to filter through into this culture, was through a pornographic site. And now that this guy brought attention to himself by publishing these pictures, even with their gross, captions, really show a sort of like aggressive, jingoistic, dismissive disposition, a smug disposition around some of the images, which is how soldiers think sometimes. They're trained to think like that. But the images were there. They were on a porn site, and that got public. The Pentagon got pissed off, reprimanded the soldiers, but, sent the local law enforcement people onto this guy and busted him on obscenity charges. And as you said, Riley, with all the obscenity out there in terms of, who's purveying
it. Why him?
Because they're making an example of him. They did it with Lenny Bruce because he outed a corrupt judge.
Yep.
A lot of people think that was all about obscenity, or Harry Reams is all about obscenity. It's about politics, man. They could never stop what they call obscenity, because obscenity is just entertainment to some people.
Yep.
We got David Gray in a minute, so hang out. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program here on Monday, Columbus Day. That is David Gray, isn't it? Yes, it is. Of course, it is. Dan Pashman's a big fan of David Gray, which worked out because, Riley, you went to the dentist.
Yes.
And David Gray stops by the studio to hang out and talk on the night of his Radio City performance. I think he was a little hungover, he said, wasn't he?
He was a little bit. We loosened him up, though. He was in good spirits by the end of the interview.
This is something we like to do on Morning Sedition. We like to have musicians play if they are capable of playing, solo in a studio, because it gives you an opportunity to hear them like you've never heard them before. I think it's a great thing. And we got David Gray to do that. So here's an interview that Dan Pashman and myself did last week. I'm sitting here with Dan Pashman. Our next guest hit the U.S. music scene in 1999 when his fourth CD, the self-financed and self-promoted White Ladder, sold 6 million copies worldwide and got nominated for a Grammy. He just released his seventh album, Life in Slow Motion, and is now touring across North America. Please welcome to the studio David Gray. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming. Now, I got to assume that after White Ladder hit it so big in the U.S. that when people started saying he's an overnight success, that must have made you a little resentful in the terms that you'd already been at it a long time, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's always there's often misconception about what actually happened or where I'm from, and but
well, let's set it straight.
Yeah, I was just delighted, to be honest, that we had some people in the audience to play to, and someone was buying the records. The rest of it didn't seem to matter too much.
How long had you been at it before that record, though? Honestly,
I think my first single came out in 1992, and mm-hmm. that's my first tour of America was 93.
Because you were huge in the UK, yes, before you got here.
It was originally in Ireland that the record broke,
yeah.
And there was a knock-on effect eventually, and it began to succeed in the UK. So by the time the success was coming here, it was getting really big in the UK. But that was a new thing there for me as well.
Yeah, one of our staff, Lucy, is from Ireland, and she was very quick to say, "We did it! We did it!"
she actually wrote a question into the guest packet that said, "The Irish are always first at everything, right?"
Yeah, I owe them about a million Guinnesses.
So first four records you did on your own at home, is that true?
Just White Ladder.
Okay.
The first three, I had various record deals, and I went to various recording studios to make those albums. But by the time White Ladder came along, I didn't have a record deal, and I didn't know if I wanted one, to be honest. And It was just a matter of doing what we could with what we had. And these days, the way that technology is with computers and sort of digital recording, you can do quite a lot for not very much money. So we just set to work in my spare room, and that was the sound of that record.
Well, that's a great story. That the record that really hits it big around the world is the one that you had the most control over. You don't hear that very often from an artist.
Yeah, no, it was a turning point for me. I think it was the first point in my career where I'd always been rather intimidated by the idea of recording. Mm-hmm. I was very comfortable playing live, but I hadn't really got to grips with the recording process. But I had to on the fourth record when I started to work at home. Well, basically, I was getting very hands-on with the whole thing, and that's when I started to move on a little bit, I think, in terms of making records.
Now, David, in contrast to that, to the White Ladder experience, let's move on to talk about your new album, which has just been released. And I think it's interesting that that's a pretty strong contrast. Not only have you gone back into the studio, you have obviously a much larger record deal at this point after that success, but you really started to utilize a lot of the effects and a lot of the instrumentation and the production that comes with a larger studio experience. And I'm curious how that came about.
Yeah, just inevitably, I think, you sort of tire of doing it one way and you start to yearn for something different, a different sound, a different approach. And suddenly I found I was ready for the whole thing with all the bells and whistles, studio, producer. We really had a go this time.
Now, were there certain things that came from that change that you might not have anticipated in terms of the musical result?
Well, often it's things you haven't anticipated. That's when it's going well, I think. It's hard to know exactly what you want, but then when you hear it, that's it. So it was a real thrill to work with some of the musicians, the string sections and the horn sections. Doing some of the sort of orchestration was brilliant. We had really, really good people, and the producer was totally in his element putting this whole thing together, and they really nailed it. So listening to something which you've sort of sketched out with a sort of synth and sort of to actually hear the real thing, it becomes really emotional suddenly, the string parts. That was just great.
After having done so much work on a computer yourself in your living room on White Ladder, was it a little bit difficult to turn over that responsibility to a producer?
No, I knew it was the right time for me to sort of delegate. It had been a team effort making the previous records, but I had to shoulder the sort of responsibility of sort of driving the whole thing through. But having a producer involved, he took a lot of that responsibility away. So I could get as involved as I want. But it left me freer to sort of think about the music, the songwriting, and look at it from a bit more distance. One of the most difficult parts of making a record is that after the fun is over, i.e. you've come up with the great idea or the song or whatever, then you've got to finish it, and you end up getting embedded in the sort of detail, and you lose the overview of the whole thing, and that's when you can completely lose the song as well.
Sure.
It was helpful for me to have someone who shouldered that responsibility for me.
Someone to say, no, David, we're leaving it.
Well, actually, yeah.
Now, David, I actually saw you in concert at Radio City Music Hall several years ago on the White Ladder tour, and I had gotten really into your music, and I'm still a big fan, and I knew every song on White Ladder backwards and forwards, and I'd gone back and gotten some of your older albums, and I was a little bit frustrated with the crowd at that concert, because it seemed to me like everyone knew Babylon and Please Forgive Me.
Yeah.
And there was like a moderate amount of knowledge of the other songs on White Ladder. If it wasn't on White Ladder, nobody knew it.
Yeah.
And that was frustrating for me, because there are some phenomenal songs there that weren't getting the response that I wanted the crowd to have.
Yeah.
Do you feel that same frustration in those situations?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's a different kind of problem to contend with, you know, when you get success. Basically, it's on the back of just a couple of songs, usually a couple of singles or whatever. But obviously, there's much more to making music than just that. In terms of when you go to a gig, we don't look forward to the single in particular. We look forward to the whole thing. And sometimes the crowd, especially when you've got a big record, like maybe 60% of them have bought tickets on the strength of just liking a couple of songs, and they're not the sort of hardcore, impassioned music lovers that you've played to in the past, when a gig will you know, really lift you up, because people just get into it and it has a sort of cumulative effect and they're with you for every song. Sometimes it's not like that. You've got to work much harder. Mm-hmm. They're sort of waiting to hear the song that they like, and there's nothing you can really do about it. You just got to stick to your guns. So some gigs end up a bit like that, I think, and others, sometimes you're expecting something like that and you get the opposite. You get we played Madison Square Garden last time, and I thought that might be exactly that, quite difficult to make the room work, but mm-hmm. I think it was like the whole audience was really into the music that night, and it really, really took off, and they just went for everything.
Oh, that's great. That must be a great feeling. Do you remember hearing Dan in that audience saying, shut up, you guys, this is a good song, too?
Were you? I was saying it to my friend Stacy who's sitting next to me. I was like,
well, why don't we have David Gray sing a couple songs? Are you going to sing some songs from the new record?
Yeah.
Wow, wouldn't that be good to hear those songs? Hang out a minute, and we'll let you. 43 past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Seven past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. That's David Gray from his new album. Dan Pasman and I talked to him last week. Riley was at the dentist, and he played for us in studio. We're going to play that song for you here in just a second. David Gray is touring North America through mid-November. For tour dates, go to davidgray.com. And now, why don't we... it'd be nice to hear that song. He did it on an acoustic guitar. He was a little hungover, so he's got that soul, that raspiness in his voice that comes from a long night of partying. So let's hear that, Chris.
This is David Gray.
David
Gray. His new album is Life in Slow Motion.
Well, this one's called From Here You Can Almost See the Sea.
From here you can almost
Excellent. Excellent. David Gray, the song was From Here You Can Almost See the Sea off his new album, Life in Slow Motion. For David Gray's tour dates, you can go to davidgray.com. That was beautiful. Are we going to do one more?
Yeah.
We are going to do one more. We're going to play it for you a little later in the show. In just a few minutes, we're also going to have the morning remembrance with, of course, Mort Mortensen. But right now, let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton, along with nine others who were inducted, enshrined, and celebrated in the National Women's Hall of Fame. The actual location of the Hall of Fame is up there in Seneca Falls, New York, where the first known women's rights convention was held. The award is for women who have made valuable contributions to society and especially to the freedom of women, a couple of which we offended on Friday, Riley, with Bruce Cherry's bit.
Uh-oh.
217 women have been chosen by a national committee of judges. Along with Clinton were Maya Lin, who designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, Dr. Rita Rossi Caldwell, who became the first female director of the National Science Foundation in 1998, Betty Bumpers, a crusader for childhood immunization, who was also Clinton's predecessor as Arkansas First Lady. Posthumous awards were awarded to Blanche Stewart Scott, a barnstormer in the early days of aviation.
Oh, yeah.
Ruth Fulton Benedict, an anthropologist whose 1934 book Patterns of Culture became an American classic. Florence Ellenwood Allen, who was the first female judge appointed by a president to a U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Mother Marianne Cope, who was sent to the Hawaiian Islands and set up a mission to deal with leprosy in the late 1800s. And Mary Burnett Talbert, co-founded the Niagara Movement, which would become the NAACP.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. Maya Lin, who was the woman that designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, is a relatively young woman. And what's fascinating about it, with all of the, all of the controversy around building at Ground Zero and what kind of memorial they would be, Maya Lin developed a memorial for Vietnam that no one ever had a problem with.
Yeah, and it's also set a sort of standard.
The
wall idea has now become a sort of sculptural archetype for creating monuments to war dead. It's a pretty profound thing.
It is a profound thing.
I walked by it when we were down there the weekend that we performed the show down there in Washington, D.C. Other smaller news stories is here we have a guy. This guy's got a good case, Riley. We got a guy, a Brazilian psychic, claims that the U.S. Armed Forces only found Saddam based. You know, I got to say something before I get any flack for this. There is another woman who was nominated for posthumously to the Women's Hall of Fame, Patricia Locke, who I believe is an Indian educator. But I got to be honest with you, I did some research. I could not find out exactly what she did, and I don't want to be rude. I went to the site.
Really?
I went to the Hall of Fame site to find out information about Patricia Locke, and I couldn't find. I spent a half hour trying to find out who she was, and I don't want to just leave her off.
And now you feel guilty.
Well, I feel guilty because
this sounds like the confessional.
Yeah, it's part of the confessional tomorrow. But maybe I don't know how to look things up on this newfangled computer, but I tried to find out exactly what she did. I know there was a monument built to her in Arizona, but yeah. I couldn't find out the exact thing, and the Hall of Fame site didn't have it either. A Brazilian psychic claims that U.S. Armed Forces only found Saddam based on his letters that provided his exact location down to the hole where he was hiding, folks. He is seeking $25 million and has decided, and the case is being decided in Brazilian courts right now. Now, if the courts uphold the claim, it will be sent via diplomatic channels to the U.S. State Department, where it will probably be put in the garbage. This guy just wrote letter after letter saying he was a psychic, he knew where he was. These are one of those things that are very hard to prove, Riley, as you can imagine.
Hey, look, if he's a psychic, I wouldn't mess with him if I were the U.S. government. I'd pay him off and leave him alone, all right? Something real bad could happen if he doesn't get his dough.
The superstitious Riley comes true.
Yay, man.
You never know.
You ever been to Minister Eyes where this guy's
No.
By the way, that's the mining part of Brazil. That's that's that part of Brazil where all the diamonds come from and all the workers are exploited. Mm. I wouldn't mess with them if I were them.
I have an appointment with Diamond Vision today to see if I'm a candidate for laser surgery.
Uh-oh.
Thanks for reminding me. Thinking about, folks, if you're thinking about being
Wait, really?
Yeah.
You're going to get rid of your glasses?
No, I don't know. I might just wear them.
Because, the glasses is like your look.
Uh-oh.
But can I have an option? Wouldn't it be nice?
No. No.
I wanted to tell people what they, if you're thinking about being a mall Santa for the holidays, the Ministry of Fun has created a set of guidelines for Santas. You got to be cuddly. You can't smell like booze. You have to have a bushy white beard that's no more than 6 inches long, and you have to have a girth of no less than 46 inches and no greater than 48 inches. So get measuring if you're thinking about that job. We'll be back with Mort Mortensen in the morning. Remember, it's 57 past the hour, Morning Sedition. It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing
all right, man.
All right.
It's Monday. It's Columbus Day. Dan Pashman, get out of here. Go in the other room. And yeah, and pick that thing up on your way out.
You notice he stays here until like 2 seconds before we're supposed to come out.
It's chaotic, my friends. Right now, folks, you know, we're going to open this segment by bringing, you know, unfortunately, it's that time of week again where we hear at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh, here we go. You all right? It's Monday.
Morning.
How you doing?
Must be Monday. Oh, gosh.
All right?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm right. It's congestion.
Sure. It's that time of year.
Morning, Riley.
Hey. God, you shocked me.
You awake or what?
No. It's not that. You never speak to me. You don't know you don't speak to any people of color.
Hush.
Racist? Oh.
You're Latino?
Yeah. Caliban Asian.
Speaking of people of color.
Yeah.
Nipsey Russell, comedian. Nipsey Russell, the comedian whose impromptu poetic mastery made him one of television's most popular game show guests during the 1970s, died last week after failing to come up with a funny rhyme for help, nurse.
See?
For years, Russell delighted audiences with his humorous topical poems. One of his more memorable four-line verses is this. The opposite of pro is con. The fact is clearly seen. If progress means move forward, then what does Congress mean? This was followed by the less popular, why the hell am I always getting scale? I appear on every game show on TV, and I can't even get more than scale. What the is up with that, Whitey? Russell appeared in few motion pictures, but in the 1978 film version of the all-black musical The Wiz, he did make a memorable Tin Man. Memorable because everything else in the film sucked. Family members can console themselves with the thought that Russell's now up in heaven, competing with Foster Brooks for Dean Martin's approval. Chicago crime boss Albert Tocco.
Oh.
Chicago crime boss Albert Tocco died of a stroke this month after a chunk of fat put out a contract on his left aorta. Yeah.
Fat put it out?
Fat.
Yeah.
Chunk of fat just flew through his veins right through his aorta and... That'll do it for you. Tocco controlled the Chicago suburbs, mainly by extorting protection money from Humvee owners to defend against their liberal neighbors' withering remarks about gas mileage. In 1986, his wife testified that Tocco admitted killing Las Vegas crime boss Tony the Ant Spilotro. Spilotro case was the basis for the film Casino. Another crime Tocco should have been charged with.
Oh, come on.
Stuck on ice. That thing just wouldn't stop.
Yeah?
Mr. Tocco, whose nickname was Caesar, went to prison 15 years ago for racketeering, conspiracy, and being part of an amusing cultural anomaly where people actually have names like Caesar and Ant.
I'm laughing. You want to blow your nose?
Yeah.
Why don't you do that?
Okay. Thanks. lot of whole milk products in
That's
here.
Better, huh? That's soy milk, man. It's in a whole milk bottle.
It says whole. Yeah, well, what the heck is that?
All right.
You're a fraud.
Well, conservation, man.
You're a fraud.
I'm a fraud for recycling? Why don't you get on with your sketch?
If you can call it that.
Mrs. Toco. Mrs. You're not in the script, Pops.
Yeah, I know. You made one mistake. You started off by saying hello.
Why don't you go out and break some pretzels?
All right. Yeah, pretzels?
Pretzels.
A week-old reference?
A week-old reference.
You're doing good. Keep going. Got any more black guys to eulogize?
You can't remember past a week, can you, Pops?
Oh, yeah, I can. What's your name again?
The honeymoon is over, man. What happened here?
My name is a can of whoop-ass for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, come on, bring it, no neck.
Oh, no. No neck? What the hell is that? it just makes me cry. Let's get on with this, okay? Mrs. Toco, who is believed to be the first mob wife to ever testify against her husband, is now living safely in the Federal Witness Protection Program in Seattle at 201 14th. Whoops. Oh, jeez. Editors. Toco's victims requested his remains be crammed into the trunk of a 1972 Chevy Impala while a tape loop plays of What's the Matter You? This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mark Morrison saying, I think I got something in my eye.
Oh, man. You all right, buddy?
Yeah.
That was some serious stuff between you and Riley.
I got nothing but love for you.
Yeah, I know you do. I there's nothing but love here. We're all happy that you're here. Did you get any of that Kringle that John Crimmins, Boy Genius, brought?
He
brought it from Wisconsin.
All the way from Wisconsin.
His mother brought it. That thing, my mother would never have something like that in the house. I didn't even know what a Kringle was. But where's Genius? Hey, Goliath, is he in there? No, little Goliath isn't in there.
He's probably out getting high.
There he is. Is there a mic in the bathroom?
I don't think he is. I think he's just like that. I think that the ironic thing about that guy is he might not ever do that. What do you think? I don't know.
Well, actually, he was telling me in college, everyone in college thought that he had good pot. He's like, hey, man, you got pot? And he's like, no, I don't smoke. He's like, really? You don't?
I got to get him in here. All right, let's shift gears. Let's talk about the... Are you okay? Do you need anything from us?
Goliath went to college?
Yeah, he did, man. He's a painter. You should talk to him. He's a painter.
Painter?
Yeah.
House?
No. Like art.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, there he is. So it was the genius line of the moment was this morning was...
I studied art history.
At
Berkeley.
You did?
Yeah.
Art really? History. How'd that work out for you? What? I studied art history.
You dug your hole, not lying in it.
Little Goliath, Dave, you know, he's... What was the genius thing this morning where you said to John Crimmins, you said, is this Scandinavian?
Oh, is the Danish Scandinavian? Yeah, I know. But it's one of those things that you don't think about.
Yeah, I guess the Danish. No, you would never, like, where would that word come from? Danish.
Yeah, I know. It's not one of my finer moments, but...
That's all right, man. It's okay. We're don't get all hurt. Now we're trying to figure out: do you smoke reefer at all?
Do I smoke reefer? Not. I haven't very much recently.
Really?
I did in college, but
you know, it's a dead giveaway when he asks you the question he just asked.
What was that like? Yeah, I mean, I can't. I'm just trying to imagine at what level do you operate?
I just completely shut down.
Really?
Like, that's why I don't do it that much because. I'm already in such a state of, like, I don't know, paranoid. I get really paranoid when I do that.
Yeah, I bet.
I really don't like it that much. Uh-huh. I do sometimes if I'm in like a really comfortable environment.
Wow, this is
I used to watch Pee Wee's Playhouse. It was like an amazing experience. That was amazing.
It seems like we've opened a door to a conversation here. I have a feeling that when we go on break, he's going to still be talking about this. Let's talk about
important. You should try it.
Oh, Pee-wee's Playhouse and getting high? I'm 42 years old. You think I've done that? You don't think I've done that maybe twice? Three times? That's a new one. Let me write that down. I'll start doing drugs. Maybe I should go see Pink Floyd's The Wall, too, while I'm at it. All right. Anyway, we'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk about real things. It's 15 past the hour. Twenty past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I am Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Monday. So Wayne Gelman's in here telling me maybe I should think twice about doing that at laser surgery. You know?
Really?
Yeah, because he doesn't know. Well, because he said sometimes a few years later you could be something wrong with your eyes. Who the hell knows, you know? And maybe I shouldn't get it. Maybe I go in for this consultation today, and I'm supposed to get it for free because I'm going to yap about it on the radio, but who the hell knows if I'm even going to be on the radio?
But Maron,
what?
On.
What?
Me, how many more years do you have left?
What the hell does that mean?
Just do it.
What does that mean?
What do you have left to lose?
Also, what, you feel like a hero because you finally had some, sexual... What? Hey, what?
That's off the air.
Oh, sorry, brother. I'm sorry. Because now I'm going to try backpedal. I am no good at backpedaling. Because you had that wonderful sex soup, that recipe I gave you?
Yeah, the sex soup was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's a weird thing to call soup, but, you know, it's a good recipe from the Caribbean, right?
Yeah, good job.
All right, thanks, buddy. I'm really good at that. How many years do I have left? At least a couple. Let's get into some important, because there's footage. CNN is running this thing over and over again. It's important to know some New Orleans cops beat the hell out of some guy, a 64-year-old man who was drunk on Bourbon Street, and an AP reporter got it on camera.
Yeah, an AP reporter also got a little assaulted, too, allegedly.
Uh-huh.
There are two cops, actually three cops, have been arrested in connection with it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, at least the New Orleans police, what's left of it, is taking this very seriously. You know, those of you who watch a little television this morning will see footage of these guys whipping up on this one guy, Robert Davis. The tape, which was taped by an AP cameraman, shows Davis getting hit at least four times in the head. And, you know, standing around getting drunk on Bourbon Street is not considered a felony in New Orleans. But then a fifth officer, after these guys wailed on Davis, a fifth officer ordered Associated Press producer Rich Matthews and his cameraman to stop recording. And when Matthews held up his credentials, the officer grabbed him, leaned him backward over a car, jabbed him in the stomach, and unleashed a profanity-laced tirade, including, "Go home."
Yeah, so that's going to work out for him. That
yeah,
cop,
that's
yeah.
going to work.
That's always good. It's like, there's a guy that just got me beating up a guy on camera. I'm going to beat him up.
Yeah. Now, see, I will say this, though. I have seen situations before where beatings by police have been captured on tape and the cops got off.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say, well, the tape didn't show what led up to the beating. The tape didn't show how belligerent the guy was. That was a situation that happened here in New York a few years ago.
Yeah.
Where a guy who was across the street from a beating videotaped the whole thing. And the cops got off because they said that they didn't videotape the bad part on behalf of the victim.
Well, these guys are claiming that they're overextended, that they're tired. Some of these cops are living in, you know, on boats, on tour boats that are have offered them their rooms. They're strung out, but that's certainly no excuse to beat the hell out of some guy for reasons that we don't know.
And by the way, the same police department is now being investigated for allegedly stealing 200 cars out of various New Orleans dealerships as Katrina headed toward the city.
Well, what we do know is that during the recovery or the reaction to Katrina is that a lot of cops went AWOL. A couple of guys killed themselves. There's been suspicion of robbery, but some guys, you know, stayed on and tried to do the work that was necessary. But these guys who are captured on tape beating the hell out of this guy definitely have something to answer for. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
So let's get into this Karl Rove issue. We're gonna have David Rakoff, who hasn't been on our show in a while, the very funny, wry, comedic wizard. His book, "Don't Get Too Comfortable," is a collection of essays that's available now. I'm looking forward to talking to him. I haven't seen him in a while. He's a good friend of mine. Well, how good is he if you haven't seen him in a while? But he is a friend of mine. I like him. I like his company. And he'll be in here in a second. But look, for Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol, on Fox News, a very conservative guy, predicted on Sunday that there would be at least one, if not more, indictments of senior White House officials means that they are in trouble. And it's, you know, Karl Rove clearly guilty of treason as far as I'm concerned. Perhaps honestly, to, you know, guilty and maybe prosecutable of perjury, maybe criminal conspiracy, has gone before the federal grand jury, prosecutor Fitzgerald, a fourth time. Definitely trying to save his own butt. There's no doubt about that, because he's been caught going back on things that he said before, not saying things he should have. Now there's new information about, you know, Judith Miller all of a sudden found another notebook has been found.
Yes, a notebook has been found in the New York Times Washington Bureau that's apparently been sitting there for 2 years.
And the reason that this is important is that she's going back to testify again, because there might be implications within these notes that she had a conversation with Scooter Libby about Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, who was outed by this conspiracy in the White House, long before it was ever assumed that these conversations happened. Long before, well, not long before, but, you know, a week or so before Joe Wilson did his op-ed piece.
Yeah, a week before Joe Wilson went public, which would say that there was concern in the White House even before the public was made aware of this whole yellow cake fiasco. And remember that this was one of the cornerstones that Colin Powell went to, and George W. Bush himself spoke to the American people, spoke to the world, and said as an established fact that Iraq had been seeking yellow cake uranium from Niger, and that they had been down there trying to make a deal. Joe Wilson blew that entire part of the rationale for invading Iraq out of the water. Stakes were high at the time.
Yeah, well, it seems like Karl Rove is being caught, as I said, perjuring himself, that Scooter Libby and he are certainly targets of this investigation, perhaps will be indicted. This will happen in the next couple weeks. And this, I think, you know, what this will show about these the neocon death cult is they did overreach. They thought they could get away with this because they thought this was just political strategizing. But it seems that you know, there's some talk that Fitzgerald is working a new angle that includes the possibility of using a provision in the federal espionage and censorship law that makes it a crime to willfully provide classified information about national defense matters to someone not entitled to it. And there any number of these guys could have done that.
Yeah, and there's a smoking gun in terms of an email to Stephen Hadley in the National Security Office saying, I talked to Matt Cooper. So there is a problem in terms of, you know, Karl Rove's contradictory statements to the FBI, to Bush himself, to the grand jury. It sounds like he's going down.
Yeah, well, that's very exciting. And it's also, he said he might have kept Bush out of the loop, but that might have been a lie. He might just be trying to protect him.
Absolutely.
It's exciting stuff. In a few seconds, we're going to talk to writer and journalist David Rakoff. So stay with us at 27 past the hour.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
It's hey,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Man, I'm all cringled out. I'm cringled. Hey, when are we playing that other David Gray song, Pashman?
End of the show.
At the end of the show, we had David Gray in here last week. We did some live music with him in an interview. We only played one of the songs. We're going to play another one of those songs in just a second. Our next guest is a writer at large for GQ Magazine and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. If you're in New York, you can see him tonight at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble at 6th Avenue and 21st Street, where he'll be signing copies of his new book, Don't Get Too Comfortable, is the name of the book. We'll also be giving away a few free copies in just a few minutes, so stick around for that. But right now, welcome to the show, writer and author David Rakoff. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thanks for the plug.
Good morning.
That's
sure.
Very nice of you.
Are you a big draw out there at the Barnes & Noble?
Hard to say.
Hey, that's the Barnes & Noble around the corner from here.
I know.
That's the one right up the block.
Yeah. It's right down the street, right here. Yeah,
yeah, literally down the block.
It is. And do they have how they set over there for chairs and stuff? Have you read there before?
I have never read there before, but I think they have a few extra chairs around that they bring out.
Are you going to go set up the chairs? That's a weird question. I'm sorry. But the reason I asked it in my head, I was thinking about the Union Square one, because the Union Square one is almost like a stage. They got like a performance outlet.
Yeah, I mean, that's the flagship. And, of course, tonight there is Joan Didion, and I'm desperate to go see Joan Didion.
And what time is she at?
At the same time.
Really? Maybe you can run over there.
Or I could rent a bus.
Just bring all your people.
Take all
over.
The people.
Do your reading on the bus on the way to see Joan Didion.
That's a great idea.
Okay, all right. So, look, have you ever had a Kringle? Do you know what a Kringle is?
You know, you said something, and I was like, oh, that's probably for the kids. I have no idea what you're talking about.
John Crimmings, whose family is from Wisconsin, they brought this, it's like a reef of pastry. It's a giant Danish that looks like you could wear it. It's like a ring.
Around your neck.
And we went through two of them here. And that's why I'm hallucinating.
Are they filled with something beyond sugar?
Oh, dude.
Cheese and cherries.
Yeah, there was cheese and cherries in one and just cherries in the other. And there's like brown sugar in it. And it's all flaky and stuff. And there's icing on top.
Yeah.
Woohoo! Ow!
We'll be ponging off the wall till noon here.
Anyways, you want to talk about your book? Here we go. So the last book, Fraud, was hilarious. This book, I'm sure, is hilarious. I want you to tell me about... I didn't even know there was a Hooters Airlines.
Yes, well, I mean, it's not a major airline. It's, you know, they've got a few planes, and they all go down to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
That's all they do?
It's a Gulf airline.
Okay.
I mean, it's literally like a Gulf airline.
Okay.
Because apparently Myrtle Beach is a big Gulf town.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so you can go from New York, Atlanta, and Baltimore, I think. Mm-hmm. So not a real research triangle, that. You know? And it's, you know, it's connected to the restaurant. And,
okay.
And, I mean, the restaurant is an extraordinary creature to me, simply because it's managed to, you put a tape dispenser right in front of my microphone, and I'm just, I can't stop playing with it now.
We did it on purpose.
Yeah. Without benefit of Kringle, I'm actually doing it.
We knew the only matter of time before Rakoff was sticking tape on his head and on his hands. So I'm trying to picture you on
Hooters Air,
and I'm enjoying it. It's hilarious.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. They're not giving you lap dances or anything like that. It was very much like the restaurant. The restaurant took itself and recreated itself, and now it's a family restaurant.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Mothers are completely comfortable taking their pre-adolescent boys to Hooters
and
for chicken rings.
And they haven't changed the outfits at all?
No, still the white athletic shirt, you know, tank tops, orange viscose shorts, white puffy white sneakers with like athletic socks, and then they all wear nude hose to sort of even out the skin tone.
Oh.
But they actually it has that chicken under heat lamps orange quality to it. So
this is the outfit they wear on the plane as well.
These are the two Hooters girls.
Okay.
There are flight attendants who know how to do stuff. The Hooters girls.
Oh, the Hooters girls are not the flight.
They're simply entertainment.
Oh.
So what do they do?
Well, it's this very benign PG entertainment. It's like,
what, you mean puppets?
Virtually. Quizzes.
Yeah.
Quizzes about Hooters-related trivia.
Oh, okay.
Things like how many sauces are there for the wings.
Really?
They're six.
Oh. Do people go, oh, I know. Do they, I mean, does that...
People know.
There's six?
My God.
How do you like that?
There's a whole part of American culture I've missed completely.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I was at a Hooters once.
My wife doesn't let me go.
I don't know. It's not that interesting.
Oh, really? You know, something, she should pick her battles and she should let you go to Hooters. Because,
really?
Yeah. Why? It's not a gateway drug anymore.
Oh, man. But I wanted to go see it when it was a gateway drug.
So now you also you did a piece in there. I didn't even realize you were Canadian. What am I, stupid? Why, how did I not know that?
You're a little late to the game. No, I am Canadian. I'm dual, actually. Now.
You're bi.
Yes.
So now one of the essays in the book is talking about how you decided to become an American citizen and what the process was.
Yeah, finally, after 23 years of living here, I decided to become an American.
But you didn't have to.
I felt that I did. I mean, I didn't, you know, it's not like it was some great timing thing right now, given the way, the standing of the United States and the rest of the world. I decided that I really needed to vote after 23 years. I was desperate to vote.
Oh, okay. All right. So is Canada disappointed? Did you get a letter from Canada?
Well, I am dual. And I just actually came back last night from a book tour in Canada.
Okay. All right.
And it came up in every interview that I gave.
Yeah.
One guy said, I don't know whether to kiss you or slap you.
Wow.
Yeah, everybody was really, it's a big thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was really incredible to be up in Canada this time. I mean, it's always sort of interesting to be in Canada because it really is a very different country, and the differences seem more pronounced than they have in years lately. But I watched a show called The Fifth Estate, and The Fifth Estate is like the 60 Minutes of Canada. It's on the CBC, you know, and it was this long piece, you know, much longer than anything on 60 Minutes, about how biased Fox News is and the making up of facts. It was this incredible disquisition about Fox News and Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, and there was none of that sort of, well, we've heard from the evolutionary biologist, now let's hear from someone whose theory is simply based in nothing, but let's give them equal time. There was none of that. It wasn't unbalanced, but it also was in no way going to give equal time to something that was patently ridiculous.
Right.
And it was extraordinary to see this. This was on the equivalent of ABC, NBC, and CBS combined.
Yeah, because here in this country, you have to wait for MoveOn.org to support some sort of bootleg DVD that you have to have dinner with other people to watch to get that same information.
It was just unbelievable to me.
And does that go for all of Canadian news? Are they more thorough in generally? Are they more...
I think there hasn't been the... Well, because there wasn't the scare tactic campaign whereby, the blowhard punditocracy of the right started accusing them of being right-wing. There was none of that sort of rush to try and find some sort of misbegotten notion of balance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the Canadian media, like the rest of the world media, except perhaps Britain, where the tabloids have got people running scared as well.
But you know what's weird? I mean, we had this tragedy that's going on in Pakistan with this earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stunned at a point to hear a report, I believe it was on NBC, and they slugged it out reporting from Tokyo. And I realized suddenly that they don't have bureaus in that part of the world anymore to cover anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't gotten anybody there yet. And maybe that's part of the reason why American coverage of a lot of different events is so slipshod, because people simply are not there.
I suppose so. I mean, then again, in their defense, if I were a reporter on the road in the wake of Daniel Pearl, I would also want to stay in Tokyo, frankly.
That's true, yeah. It is frightening, and it takes a certain amount of courage to, like, do any reporting. But, like, you are not that hard.
Not the courage. My kind of reporting takes no courage, alas. I'm the rodeo clown of the Fourth Estate.
So let's talk about the cutting-edge reporting you did at a softcore Playboy TV shoot.
Uh-oh. Well, that for me was difficult.
Yeah.
What was boring is the main thing.
Does it do it for you, huh?
It really doesn't do it for me. But, I mean, when, you know, regardless of Kinsey placement, it's just boring. I mean, it's softcore, so... I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I want to see some hardcore.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so ubiquitous. The images of... you know, pneumatically enhanced hairless women are everywhere. I mean, they might not be everywhere to your guys' satisfaction, but I can tell you, speaking as someone who's just like barely a media consumer, they're everywhere. There was simply not a visual surprise anywhere.
Nothing interesting happened.
Nothing.
Really?
And it's really, really hot in the Caribbean. You know, it's like... It's this beautiful, lush locale where they're filming things, and I don't like direct sunlight. Like, I mean, I put on, like, heavy shoes today and a jacket and a sweater, and I've never been happier. It's like waking up out of a coma.
I'm the same way. Fall for me is the best.
How did you get this gig?
I know. Well, I'm very fortunate in that many editors seem to think it's fun to send me places that'll just scare the hell out of me or make me deeply uncomfortable.
I saw that there was a piece in there. I was recently on Good Morning America. I was asked to be on Good Morning America.
Wow.
And
interviewed you?
It wasn't an interview. I was one of the culture correspondents, me.
You know? Oh, my goodness.
I talk about politics all day long, and I'm sitting there in front of Bill Weir, who looks at me and says, I guess the biggest story of the week is Ashton and Demi, huh? And, like, I literally had to go, yeah. I didn't have to, but I didn't want to sabotage everything. But the weird thing was is they had a corral of middle-aged women as an audience, literally corralled there, standing. You know, waiting for Winona Judd. And that was my audience. And I did okay. I pandered. But you were a part of an audience?
I was in that corral. Well, not that corral. I was at the Today Show corral. You know, it turned out to be a rather sweet community of people. I had gone there with this idiotic hypothesis that, you know, I'm really going to see some appalling behavior. People who want to do anything to be on television. And because it seems about as culturally in the loop as you are.
Yeah.
I had entirely neglected the fact that all of television now is programmed with people whose parents are presumably still alive, who will wear a thong and eat a beef rectum on television.
Yeah.
So, in fact, standing outside of a studio in your street clothes with a little sign that says, Hello, Medicine Hat Canada.
Yeah.
You might as well. Yeah, it's like Louisa May Alcott came up with that. It's so sweet. So, but I did spend a week there.
Yeah.
The one thing that was a little upsetting is that, you know, the area outside the Today Show, it's in New York. It's in Rockefeller Center. It's one of the most beautiful places in New York City.
Yeah.
It's lost on these people.
Yeah,
they're not in New York. They just see the amber window of
the
studio.
It's another ride at the park.
completely.
I see that all the time. I notice that too. Like, I didn't find anything contemptible about the corral of women at the at Good Morning America. They all seemed very nice. They were excited to be there, but they were just on the Good Morning America ride.
Yeah,
they're like, here we go. Where's Diane?
It's just another tourist attraction. I mean, you know, they come out of the hotels. It's no accident. It's right near all of those hotels in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah,
and people can come out. It's like, you know, going to a Broadway show, only cheaper.
Well, is it
free?
Free. That's right. You just got to get up and be out in the cold. They'll go out there no matter what the weather is. We were going to try and get Pashman to go down there with a sign that said Morning Sedition on it. That was one of those great ideas that never really came to fruition. Did it, Dan?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, it's no problem.
I used to do that for a different radio station.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, good. Well,
that's awful.
I'm glad you brought it up, and we're willing to do it here to get our ratings up now that I'm, you know, on the grill here. Anyways, so you're also a contributor to This American Life. I've heard you on This American Life. I had no idea they were doing a TV show. Are you on it?
I'm not on. Well, they've only done the pilot so far.
How is it?
It's good.
Yeah. You like it?
Yeah.
That's good. Are you being diplomatic? Or?
No, I prefer radio to television.
Yeah. Ah. I do, too. You know why? Because I can do this until I'm 100 if someone lets me, and I live. And in TV, you're very limited because it's like if you're...
I can't even do it now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to picture you wearing a thong and eating a beef rectum.
What do you got to tell people what I'm doing in the studio right now? You know what I mean? This is what we eat for breakfast on radio. Beef rectum. See, it's funny you bring up rectum because actually...
Oh, here
Chris,
we go.
Chris, our sound guy, looked at the Kringle, which I described to you earlier, which is a large toilet seat-sized ring of Danish,
yes,
and said, "Wow, it looks like a rectum." Where do you get that from, a large, you know, coffee seat-sized Danish?
Wow.
Yeah, all right. Don't, you know, if you didn't come up with anything right
well,
away.
No, no, no. What I'm thinking is that he actually probably meant anus.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I think the rectum is more of a channel and the anus is more of the opening.
Okay, the opening. I was just saying, see, now we're
good
getting
morning.
Specific.
Hey.
How are you? Yeah, David Rakoff's new book is called Don't Get Too Comfortable, which we're not right now. But he will be performing tonight. You will be appearing at Barnes & Noble right here on, 6th Avenue?
6th Avenue 21st.
It's right,
yeah, I'll be reading.
Around the corner, you'll be reading. You're a very funny reader. You're a very funny man. The essays are very funny. And I'm a big supporter of David Rakoff and always have been since we shared that plane ride to Aspen where I comforted you the entire way.
Yes, that was very sweet of you. Thank
okay.
You, by the way.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Thanks a lot.
48 past the hour. We're going to do a book giveaway now, 866-303-2270. If you want to win Don't Get Too Comfortable by David Rakoff, call us and we'll just give it to you. When we come back, David Gray is going to be in your ears. How's that? 48 past the hour.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, we're going to land this thing. It's Mark Brown here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Columbus Day. I want to congratulate our winners of David Rakoff's book. The book is Don't Get Too Comfortable. We had winners in Texas, New Jersey, San Francisco, and Georgia. The Air America is nationwide, my friends.
Yeah.
Nationwide. Right now, we're going to hear a bit of business that Dan Pasher and I, last week, David Gray stopped by, played some songs, and talked to us a little bit before he did Radio City that night. He's on tour. We'll give that information in a second, but here's the other song that he played during that interview.
Okay, this next one is called The One I Love. I believe it's my current single.
Gonna close my eyes. Little prayer out to you across the falling down. take my hand, darling, on that old dance floor. We could twist and shout, do the turtle dove. Then you're the one I love. You're the one I love. The one I love.
All right, that was a current single, The One I Love. That was David Gray. His new album is Life in Slow Motion. He is on tour. If you're looking for tour dates, you can go to davidgray.com. It was really a pleasure having you here. Thanks for getting up and doing this.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Have a great day, folks. It's 57 past the hour. It's Monday, Columbus Day. Tomorrow we got actor Michael Imperioli on the phone. Greg Barrett, co-author of He's Just Not That Into You. He's a comedian as well. We'll be here. Riley, we did all right for a Monday, huh?
Yeah, we did good for a Monday, man.
All right.
Except for that guy Jim Earl.
Oh.
Only kidding. Air America Radio.